So these professors walk into a comedy club. It was about a team of experts from the Humor Research Lab at the University of Colorado designing a humor algorithm to identify the funniest cities among the largest cities in America. So who won? Who lost? Plus, it turns out that one of the people, well, the guy who runs the center at the University of Colorado, is co-author of a very entertaining book, The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny, which includes, and I gotta tell you, I read this chapter word for word, how can you win the cartoon caption contest in The New Yorker? What's it like to do stand-up comedy? Our guest is Professor Peter McGraw, who directs the Humor Research Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. His work is in the interdisciplinary fields of emotion and behavioral economics. He's also co-author of that book, and he and his co-author traveled all over the planet with some very interesting research topics, stories from Tanzania, where in 1962, hundreds of people were seized by uncontrollable laughter. I think that needs to happen to us at the end of this week. From the Amazon, where they examine therapeutic humor. From Japan, can comedy be lost in translation? So that's some of what we'll talk about this hour with Peter. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Peter McGraw, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah. Before we talk about the funniest cities, I love the part of the book where you were attempting to do, and it begins and ends the book, stand-up comedy, which I think has to be one of the most difficult things in the world, and I'll bet you your experience will bear that out.
Yeah, it was one of the worst decisions I've ever made. And also, as a consequence of doing the book, it's also one of the best decisions I've ever made.
Exactly. I'm sure it is. So what in the world is a humor research lab? What do you study?
Well, instead of calling it the Humor Research Lab, I'd prefer you call it by its acronym, HURL.
Okay.
And so it's so people have these visions of the Humor Research Lab as a room filled with shelves filled with whoopee cushions and and rubber chickens and clown noses and so on. But really, it's a lab like most other behavioral labs at a university, and it's really just filled with people who want to answer the question, what makes things funny? And look at why that's important.
So when you look at what makes cities funny, the New York Times article looked at the 50 biggest cities and which were the funniest and which were the least funny. How in the world do you take that on as a project?
Well, yeah, there are times where I was like, oh, we've made a huge mistake.
I bet.
But we knew that, you know, we knew we couldn't make everybody happy. And really, one of the things that the folks in the Humor Research Lab and my co-author, Joel Werner of the Humor Code, really want to do is not just talk about the science of humor, but to try to get people out in the real world talking about this sort of mysterious, complex phenomenon, to get them thinking about it and how much they value it and how they go about pursuing it. And we thought, one is, A, this is an interesting question, and academics just they have the pleasure of just asking interesting questions.
Right.
But we also thought it would be one that would get people talking. And so we took our time with them. This one we got this idea about 9 months ago and finally got our act together and got the report written.
I'm so glad the city that came in, it's my hometown. So the fact that Chicago, which you wouldn't think would be number one, but it's number one.
Yeah, well, you know, actually, one of the things that I had some fun with was knowing the results and then telling people that we had done the project and asking them to guess who had done well. And in that way, Chicago does surprisingly well. People often come up with Chicago as their funniest city. Boston does well, but then we also had some surprises.
Yeah. And do you think Chicago, because of the vast number of comedians from Second City that it has given us and all the early comics in the city, why was that a big thing? Second City.
Well, yeah. So I think that the values around comedy certainly follow from that long history of Second City as a feeder to Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
But when you look at Chicago, it just does well overall. So traveling comedians rate it as having great audiences. You have all these famous comedians. There's a good number of comedy clubs there, which we correct for by square mile. So you'd think that Chicago's breadth might hurt it in some way. And that propelled it into the top 10. And then what got it number one really had to do with the residents, not the famous humor producers there. When you look at we ran a survey of over 900 respondents in the top 10 cities, and just Chicago is in the top five for so many things. So it ranks number one on a personality scale, need for levity. So this is a scale that measures people's desire for playfulness, for humor, for jokes in their life. And then it shows up as, it's number two on use of Comedy Central as a news source. It's number two for preference for funny friends. It's number three for preference for funny romantic partners and so on. And so there seems to be just overall it does well.
You can't understate the importance of a funny romantic partner, don't you think?
Oh, I think that that's right. So if you ask people what's the most important characteristics in a partner like that, good sense of humor is often number one, and it's certainly in the top three.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we've looked at in the humor code. This idea that having a funny romantic partner, and when I say funny, I just mean one that you think is funny and who thinks you're funny.
Yeah,
no
right.
one else in the world
right.
has to think
Absolutely.
That you're funny.
Yeah.
Is that they're just great company, right? They bring you a lot of positive emotion.
Yes.
And there's this long history of using comedy to cope with difficult circumstances. And so when someone's able to transform the things that are wrong in the world into something that's delightful, they make good company. And then the last thing is that if you laugh at the same thing that I laugh at, it means that we probably see the world in the same way.
Interesting.
And that helps a lot when it comes to those relationships.
Right. So what does it mean, a good audience? You've had to perform in front of audiences. Why does Chicago have good audiences? They're receptive to humor that may not even be terrific? They're kind? What is it?
So we left this as a pretty open question. So we surveyed a bunch of touring comedians, and we just said, how good are these audiences? And we gave them all 50 cities. And so some of it is left to the eye of the beholder. So my guess, knowing stand-up comics, and Joel and I on our Humor Code travel spent a lot of time with stand-up comics, what determines a good audience usually is how readily they laugh.
Right.
Just how easy is it to make them laugh?
Yeah. Boston is number two. Is that a surprise?
Mm-hmm. No, I think it makes sense. The only thing surprising about it is that for people in Boston, they weren't number one. I've been taken to task by Bostonians for why they're not number one. But they do really well on that survey also. So they love funny movies, funny TV shows, funny books, funny cartoons in the newspaper. They're number five for funny friends. They aren't in the top five for funny romantic partners.
Oh, there's a downfall. And obviously they've never been to Chicago, right?
Well, what's really great about Boston is that we ask people to characterize the city. And one thing that's really interesting about Boston is its diversity with regard to comedy. So it's this really nice mix of highbrow and lowbrow humor style. So you've got the kind of drunken debauchery that Boston's known for, and then you have these highbrow intellectual jokes that came our way. And a whole bunch of them, even the smart folks in the Humor Research Lab, really, they were too smart for us. We couldn't understand them.
Now, this one surprised me. I spent some time living in this city, and I didn't find it particularly funny, but then again, the work I was doing was deadly serious. Atlanta is number three.
Oh, and they are ecstatic to beat New York City.
Oh,
very, very happy about that. You know, I think this is a relatively new phenomenon for Atlanta. I think it's a city that's doing well, and it's become an entertainment hub, and it certainly has been attracting. I think that this happens is where kind of strength begets strength, and so you have funny people there, and it it attracts other funny people, and then it also gives people a chance to enjoy it. But yeah, Atlanta did really well in the survey. So number one for funny movies, number three for funny television shows. So a lot of entertainment based stuff. So it's really a big part. They're even number five as Comedy Central as the news source. I'm not sure TNT is, and CNN is happy about that.
Yeah. So are you saying though that actually nobody from Atlanta, none of the funny people from Atlanta, are from Atlanta originally?
Oh, you know, I don't know. Thank you for asking me that question. I don't know. I'm hesitant to say. But I think that it's been, because it's a place where television's being made, it's certainly attracting folks.
Yeah. Washington is number four. I would think there's a city there's so much material for comedy, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think that there's, you know, it's, yeah, it's, and certainly with the connection of, political satire and its you know, its long history in this country, and the fact is that one of the things that we talk about often in the humor code is about how humor arises from things that are sort of wrong, from things that seem to be amiss, what we call violations. And when you talk about government, you have lots of those things,
right?
And then the use of comedy to critique the people in power. You know, this goes all the way back to the court, you know, to the court jester. And so in that way, I think that D.C. provides a lot of good material and material that people are often used to making jokes about.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, we'll do the top five and we'll get to top 10 in a moment. This city, the New York Times article says, known for its celebration of oddballs and weirdness, and the city is yeah. Portland, Oregon.
Yes.
Are they thinking of that TV show? What's the name of that? My stepson.
Portlandia. I wouldn't be surprised, right? So if you can create an entire comedy television show just about a city, there's got to be something going on there.
Right.
And what was funny is that how Portlandians, Portlanders, I don't know what they call themselves, they embrace it. You know, they are basically like, yeah, we're just weird. And so you get this kind of, and I think that they sort of celebrate that weirdness. Keep Portland weird. You see it all the time.
Yeah. The least funny city, or the bottom two.
Yes, I'm getting calls from them also.
Oh, I'll bet.
Yeah. So actually, I'm waiting for Jacksonville. But Jacksonville came in at 49 and Fort Worth, Texas at 50.
Oh.
And I just want to say is that they're not the least funny. They're just the worst of the best. There's a difference there, and that is that there are a lot of cities much less funny than Fort Worth and Jacksonville. It's just we didn't happen to look at them. You know, we had to limit this to a tractable number of cities, so we picked the top 50 in population. But one of the things that really hurts Fort Worth, and my heart goes out to them, is that we do all these corrections. So we correct for population size, or we correct for geographic region. So we look at comedy clubs per square mile, for instance. And, you know, everything's bigger in Texas. And so in this case, when you correct for them being big, they end up moving down a few spots than they would have from some absolute scale.
Well, I didn't even know there were any comedy clubs anywhere in Texas.
Oh yeah, Austin though. Austin is the one shining star
yes.
in the Lone Star State. So Austin comes in at 14, and I'll tell you this: the comedians love those Austin audiences.
Hmm. Yeah, Austin sounds like a fun city. I must ask you before we invite phone calls: what about Milwaukee, where we are? Are we funny?
Yes. So
no.
I was talking to your producer, and I said it's 34, and she felt good about it. And then I read all the cities that fall below it, and then she said, that's not helping me.
So we're not real funny. Well, we have little pockets of funny.
But here's the thing. I've actually thought – I made a joke on Twitter yesterday that I'm starting a consulting agency to help people move up the rankings.
Oh, there you go.
If you think about it, there's no reason that you're fixed there, right? There's all these things that you can do to move up the funny rankings.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour – is the co-author of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. Maybe you saw the piece in the New York Times on Sunday in the Sunday Review section, which has a funny title. So these professors walk into a comedy club. And they did. And they came up with an algorithm for what makes a city particularly funny. And Chicago was number one of the top 50 cities. Boston, number two. In case you missed our show, Atlanta, number three, and Washington, number four, Portland, Oregon, number five. We're welcoming phone calls. We have a lot more to talk about with our guest because he also is the co-author of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. So there's a lot of material there, which we will branch into. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. We thought that we needed to be happy here because we've been on some heavy topics, and should be, but every now and then, everybody needs to be a little happy, so that's this hour with our guest. Dr. Peter McGraw is an expert in the interdisciplinary field of judgment, emotion, and choice. He's an associate professor of marketing and psychology at the Leeds School of Business at the University of Colorado Boulder, where he directs the HURL Lab, which stands for Humor Research Lab. And so we go to you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Peter McGraw. 800-486-8655 is our number. Bill is calling from Aspen, Wisconsin. Hey, Bill.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey. I just wondered if you could say something, someone could say something funny.
I could tell you what my favorite joke that came out of the Chicago survey was, and I think
good. All right,
you'll get it. It said that if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes.
It's true, Bill. Why don't you say something funny, Bill? Are you there? Bill's not there, but actually,
Bill said something funny. he's been the funniest person on so far.
He's been the only person on so far except for us.
That's true.
But I guess it's our job to be funny, too. Thank you, Bill, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. That's a dimension I had not thought of. If we all need to be happy, feel free to call in and make us laugh, too. Yeah. And my funny thing is, this is really kind of a sad story, but it became funny. When I was in sixth grade, I got a D in art. I've remembered that my whole life. How could you give a kid a D in art? So I didn't know how to draw. I still don't know how to draw a darn thing, but I figured I got to do something about this. So my dad helped me out, and I found, and he was a real jokester. So I had a picture of two guys fishing, and one guy had, like, you know, 50 fish, medium size, on this pole, and the other guy had one huge fish. And the guy with 50 fish, you know, they were little fish, actually, said to the guy with one huge fish, "Oh, you only caught one?" And my teacher thought it was very, very funny, and I got an A on that. It's the only time I got an A, and the rest I kept failing the class, but it was humor that got me through that class. I'll always remember that. In addition,
and you're a big fan of the New Yorker cartoons.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you missed your calling.
Oh, no. I keep entering so many contests. Do you too, Peter? I get so excited because I'm sure that what I've put together is the funniest thing in the world, and then I look at the finalists, and I've never, ever been able. I just want to get a T-shirt, you know? Don't
well,
you?
I've learned not to submit because one of the things that Joel and I did for the Humor Code was we got the keys to the vault.
I know you did.
We got to basically see.
Yeah.
We got to hang out with Bob Mankoff and talk for hours on end about the New Yorker cartoons. And one of the things that you have to understand is that to win the caption contest, the odds are against you.
Yeah.
I mean,
you have
a better chance of getting a hole in one
right. In
golf.
I know. And you did a special thing. There was a special day, wasn't there, where you sat around a table and you came up with, you and Joel came up with a cartoon that I thought was number two, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, it was a the New Yorker conference that they have every October, and Bob was leading one of the sessions about the cartoons, and we broke off into groups and were competing against people a lot smarter than us there, and I think that either Joel or I probably had one too many flutes of sparkling wine.
Uh-huh.
That might have been what held us back.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, you do, and we won't give it away, but you give us some advice on what you should do. No questions, a certain number of words in order to even be in the running for that contest.
Yeah, we got a chance to analyze some data and hurl and got some insights that might help your listeners at least try to make it into the finals.
Right. Let's go to Joe in Duluth. Hi, Joe.
Hey, you guys. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Good. My question has to do with like the up-and-coming newer comedians or younger comedians and how much social influence impacts their, not just their stand-up, but if you look at their brand, how much they have to do for stand-up, how much they have to do for writing, how much they have to blog. You know, when you advise them, how much are you saying this is an important part, especially with the change in like late night? Mm-hmm. See the new performers mm-hmm. doing a lot more stuff with singing, dancing, you know, just a more genre. Just curious.
Yeah, I think that your observation is spot on. One of the really fascinating things about the internet is that I kind of think of it as leveling the playing field a little bit for these up and coming comics. You know, it used to be that if you wanted to hit it big, you had to wait for Carson to call you. And what's happening now, though, is that not everybody's that kind of stand-up. Their stuff doesn't translate very well to the late night television shows, and people are making themselves famous with their podcasts. You can think about Marc Maron, or people are making themselves famous on Twitter, like Rob Delaney. And now they can tour, which is where comics really make their money. And they have an audience who knows them, who's reached them because they've seen their YouTube videos or listened to their podcasts or their blog. And in some ways, that generates demand, and you don't have to wait for the kind of gatekeepers who usually made the decisions back in the day. And so to be a comic and not do all those things, at least not have your toe dipped into those areas, I think might be a big disadvantage these days.
Mm-hmm.
And last question, who would you now consider to be the gurus or, you know, the roast masters? Who is the, you know, like, hey, they gave you the nod, you're moving on. Is it the Jeffrey Ross, the Seinfeld? Who do you consider the elite gurus are now for comedies?
Wow, that's a tough one. So in the Humor Code, Joel and I get to meet Louis C.K., mm-hmm. and I get to talk to him about my humor theory, about what makes things funny. And Louis quickly shoots down the theory. He's not a big fan of my science. But with that said, I'd have to give him the nod. And the reason that I think that Louis C.K. is probably at the top of the game right now is not only is his stand-up for, you know, 4 or 5 years now among the best, he has one of the most interesting television shows, and one that he's managed to avoid the normal gatekeeper. So he has a show on FX called Louis, and he delivers the final cut of the episode. And so he doesn't have the suits at the station making changes to his work. He gets to say exactly what he wants to say in the way that he wants to say it. And I think that makes for a really innovative show.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Joe, for the call. Our number, we have lines open if you'd like to join us and talk about the funniest cities in the world or humor in other countries or stand-up comedy or what makes something funny or tell us something funny. You can do all of that. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. Going back to stand-up for just a moment here, Peter. We did this show, Pioneers of Television, with comedians. We talked to the producer of the show last week, and it was with Seinfeld and Roseanne Barr and a number of other comedians. And it was interesting to hear their interviews because so many of them wanted to go back to doing stand-up. And people like Leno, even though he was doing The Tonight Show, would spend his weekends doing stand-up mm-hmm. comedy. What was
that?
Yes,
at the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa Beach on Sunday nights. You could always find Leno there trying out his jokes.
Why? Why is that? You've done stand-up. Why?
Well, by the way, the people who really want to do it are the people who are really good at it. And I think that there is something about the immediate feedback that you get with stand-up comedy. It's a lot like being a musician and playing in front of a live audience, is that you get this immediate feedback, like you're doing well, right? When you're killing, you know it. And you also know that in many ways it's a audience that's like, all right, go ahead, try to make me laugh, right? There's a little bit of you know, challenge there. And I think that there's something addicting about that kind of adulation that happens, where people are laughing and clapping and wanting more and more.
Yeah.
You're delighting people in ways that most of us don't get to do often.
Yeah, what a joy it must be to be really good at it. It must just be wonderful.
Yeah, and by the way, though, I think that, you know, so a Seinfeld is an exception in the sense that he was pretty good pretty quickly. But even still, Seinfeld has gotten really good slowly, and he's been pretty public about talking about the underlying process, the constant testing, the constant writing, the constant finding chances to get on stage late at night in these, you know, dark, dank comedy clubs. And that really, you know, you don't find outstanding stand-up comics who are 22 years old. You find outstanding comics who are 32 years old or 42 years old, because it takes 10 years to get really good at it. It's a hard process.
Yeah. Scott in La Crosse. Hey, Scott.
Hey there, Kathleen.
Hi.
As a proud graduate of the University of Colorado, class of 1969,
all right,
I would like to ask the guests, how funny is Boulder? and has it gotten any funnier since they legalized marijuana?
So, Denver comes in eighth on our list. And so Boulder was too small to get considered. And I'd say that... Boulder still has a little ways to go. I think the weed helps a bit, right? So there is some evidence that you get this nice positive mood boost from marijuana, and in that way it helps kind of decrease the threat of a scary world out there, and helps a bit of laughter. We don't have our own comedy club still, but there's some open mics in Boulder now, which is at some coffee houses and at some of the bars and so on, and but yeah, you know, if we also looked at the number of funny tweeters in each city, and if I'm the funniest tweeter in Boulder, then Boulder's really in trouble.
Have you ever done stand-up comedy or wanted to, Scott?
Oh, no, I'd be nuts. No, no, no.
No?
I wouldn't go there. Although, one thing that always cracked me up in Boulder, and I don't know if it's still the case, but legendarily, nobody knows the words to the school song. You just don't know them. So when it's time at a football or basketball game to get up and sing the school song, everybody stands up. You know, like they do at Wisconsin to sing Varsity. Well, everybody stands up, but they just hum along until the very last line, which is "Dear old CU," and then everybody just suddenly starts sings that line because it's the only thing we know.
That's funny.
Got to the point where I refer to my alma mater as "Dear old."
It's funny,
so now
Scott.
I'm dear old myself, so it's even better. Enjoy the show, folks.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks very much. That's good.
Yeah, you know, Scott's reluctance to do stand-up is, I think, it's well placed. So, you know, the Humor Code Project really started because of a failed stand-up attempt. So my co-author, Joel Warner, was writing a story about the Humor Research Lab, and he invited me to an open mic night and said, hey, I want you to use your theory and critique the comedians. And I must have been having a really good day, because I said, why don't I tell some jokes? And things didn't break my way that night. But it really made me realize that if you want to crack the humor code, you need science. You need a laboratory and the scientific method. But you need to get out into the real world and see these things.
Sure.
And you know, so spending time with comics in Los Angeles or with cartoonists in Scandinavia or clowns in the Amazon – that really has helped my research, and I think it's helped sort of broaden our perspective with this
book. It's definitely broadened your perspective. You went to great lengths to find out what makes things funny. Maureen in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make an observation about Chicago and Boston and their strong connection with Ireland. Uh-huh. And having had a trip to Ireland last summer, realized how important humor was to the people of Ireland and the stories and the jokes.
Yeah.
And even in tragedy, they find something humorous, and wondered if you had any insight into that connection.
Oh, I think that's an interesting observation.
Yeah, indeed. So we actually had even grander plans for the Humor Code, and then we ran out of money. And so we were unable to go to the UK. We were eager to go to try to understand the British sense of, you know, sort of dry sense of wit. And one of the things that I was and still am eager to do, this may sound a bit macabre, but I want to go to an Irish wake.
Mm.
And I think that the Irish have more than a lot of other cultures an ability to kind of to cope and to complain humorously. And you could say it's the weather, you could say it's the challenges that the country has faced over time, and a bit of cheerfulness of the people in general, and then maybe a few pints of lager thrown in. There does seem to be a great value of with regard to the Irish and their sense of humor. I've found that to be the case with the Australians also, and in some ways I think it has to do with the fact that Australians are really quite comfortable joking with anyone, even strangers.
Yes.
On the street.
Yes.
And it makes it for a really wonderful place to visit.
Oh, it sure does. I haven't been to Australia, but it sure is true of Ireland. Thanks, Maureen, very much for the call. What about Japan? Part of the book is Can Comedy Be Lost in Translation? Did you find comedy in Japan?
Well, yes. So actually, that's what drew us to Japan, was that when we told our friends that we were going to do this project, they said, you have to go to Japan and you have to explain Japanese comedy to me. And so we're like, okay. And one of the things, so there's something really striking about Japan coming there from the United States, is that it's very difficult to find laughter in Japan.
Is
that
it?
Is
really?
It is, it's not because the Japanese don't have a sense of humor. They're actually very funny people. It's just that the cultural norms are much different than an open society like the U.S., where you can make jokes nearly anywhere. It's just not appropriate to show your emotion in places of work and in education and even on the subway. And so then people aren't making jokes.
Oh.
And so you might at first go, oh, this is not a funny place at all. And yet they have a vibrant comedy scene. And it's one, though, that is sort of perplexing to Americans who've ever seen a show like Wipeout or one of these weird variety shows. And what Joel and I found on the Humor Code travels was that the reason that these Japanese are sort of subjecting themselves to these like horrible situations is that those Japanese are comedians. And so it adds to the entertainment value, because everybody knows these comedians.
Oh.
And these comedians are able to make good jokes in the face of terrible pain.
Oh.
And then after the show, if you go to a karaoke bar or to a regular bar and you hang out with Japanese, you realize that they are very funny people and will share laughs with the best of them, as long as they're in the right place.
Huh. Tracy in Spring Green, hi.
Hi, thanks for the show.
Sure.
You must have a great job, sir. That sounds like a lot of fun, researching humor. I was wondering if part of your studies had to do with a person's ability to laugh at themselves. If someone is perceived as being self-deprecating and can laugh at themselves, are they perceived by other people as funnier? And my example for this is that I was never a big fan of Jay Leno when he was on The Tonight Show, because any time one of his guests tried to tease him, he didn't laugh. He didn't laugh about himself. He was very game to tease his guests. And so I never sort of liked him very much.
Oh.
I thought, gosh, he doesn't have a very big sense of humor about himself. I wonder if you've studied any of that.
Yeah, so this notion of self-deprecation is really a fascinating one. And I was fortunate to learn one really useful lesson when it comes to self-deprecation. So at the beginning of the book, I try stand-up, and then At the end of the book, the reason the book got written was I invited Joel to do this project with me, and he said, I'll do it under one condition, and that's that when we're done our travels, you get up on stage again, this time at the world's largest comedy festival.
Montreal, right?
Wasn't it Montreal? Yeah, the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival, and prove we've learned something. And I foolishly said yes again. And one of the things that I did, one of the things I've learned is that stand-up comics, the next time you watch a stand-up comic, when he or she starts his set or her set, they'll often make a self-deprecating joke. They'll start by making fun of themselves. So in Montreal, I won't give away everything that happened, but I said, I've learned that it's important to get a laugh right away, which is why I'm wearing this sweater vest. So I was wearing a sweater vest at the time. I'm probably the only comic person in the whole festival wearing a sweater vest, and it got a laugh. And I think it gets a laugh for this reason that we talk about in Hurl. It's a benign violation. You're pointing out what's wrong with you, but because you're doing it to yourself,
yes,
it makes it okay. It makes this violation benign. And as a result, you end up actually, I think, being a more likable person also, because you're not taking yourself too seriously. And then I think that it gives you great license then to point out what's wrong with everything else in the world.
Right.
And comedy really does that a lot. And so if you can point out what's wrong with yourself, then I can point out what's wrong with the audience, or what's wrong with the government, or what's wrong with anything out there. And so self-deprecation is a good tactic. Now, there is one problem with it, and that's if you fail to be funny.
Exactly. And now, right. There you are with a sweater vest and nobody's laughing.
And everybody just thinks you're a fool. Yes.
Oh, thanks, Tracy. So do you wear sweater vests because you were successful all the time now?
No, I just wear a sweater vest because I'm a nerd, and nerds wear a sweater vest.
Good. Yeah, well, they're good. I like vests, too. Vests are good things. Yeah.
I also have really long arms, and so when you have a sweater vest, you never have to worry about the length of the sleeves.
Absolutely. You're right. Karen in Woodstock. Hi.
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 I thought I would just call and share a really quick, short little story that I hope is good for a laugh.
I hope so, too.
Years ago, I was working in this really wonderful restaurant, and it was a slow day for lunch, so I was working it with another girl, and this group of morticians came in for lunch. They were coming in for their monthly meeting, and we thought, oh, this should be interesting. And they were cracking the most hilarious one-liners all through lunch. We couldn't stop laughing. Things like, yeah, I get home from work, and my wife says, how was work, dear? And I say, really dead, you know, that sort of thing. And they just kept this going and going. And so my friend and I thought, they've just been so wonderful. What could we leave them with? So we came up with a little one-liner of our own and went back to the table and took them their check. And we stood there and we said, we just want to thank you so much. You've entertained us and we've enjoyed it so much. We just have one thing to say. Don't stiff us. And they just cracked up. And it was just one of those hilarious, it was 1 hour of my life that I'll never forget because I laughed the whole time. Aww. And it was just wonderful. And I just wanted to share that.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you.
That's really thrilling to hear. I really do think I have the best job ever. And one of the reasons that it is because it's given me such license to make jokes, and it's given me a chance to write things that are funny. And so as a result, I just think that you know, and I think Joel recognized this in the book, that he felt, you know, and he had people tell him that he became funnier as a result of immersing himself in this perplexing topic. And so to hear someone be able to have such an enjoyable experience at work, a place that people don't always associate with play, it makes me very happy.
Yeah. Thanks, Karen, so much for your call. We'll take more in a moment. Our guest is Professor Peter McGraw. He directs the Hurl Lab, the Humor Research Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. We thought about him because of the New York Times story on Sunday, which is titled, So These Professors Walk Into a Comedy Club, and what they did did was walk into a lot of comedy clubs and got a sense of what makes a city funny and came up with the 50 funniest cities in the United States. Chicago came out number one. We Midwesterners can be proud of that. He also is co-author of a book that goes beyond funny cities. It goes to funny things in the world, really. The Humor Code, a global search for what makes things funny. One line is open. If you would like to call, then it's yours. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number, 800-486-8655. And we go to Steve in Belleville next. Hey, Steve.
Hi, how's it going?
All right, how are you?
Good.
Good.
Hey, I got two questions. Originally, I had a different question, but that was stolen. Thanks, Maureen and Eau Claire, for that. secondly, it gave me time to think about my next two questions. And one of them is, A, can your guest explain why the French deem Jerry Lewis as so funny?
Oh, yeah.
And
good.
If he knows the next question, does he know the joke that Gilbert got a check at the Friars Club this weekend?
That what? I didn't hear that, Steve. That what?
Gilbert Gottfried told a joke that was so horrible at the Friars Club this weekend, it caused Shecky Green to quit the Friars Club.
Oh, I don't know about that story. Peter?
Okay, so we'll go to your second question first, because I just forgot what your first one was.
Jerry Lewis.
Jerry Lewis, yes. Okay, good. The Jerry Lewis question is one that we answer in the Humor Code. So we ran a study, not asking why the French love Jerry Lewis, but whether the French really love Jerry Lewis. And we actually got 100 French respondents and 100 U.S. respondents and to judge Jerry Lewis and a bunch of other things, French and American, and to try to understand if this is indeed the case. And I don't want to ruin it, but the results were a little bit mixed. Mm. So... they do like Jerry Lewis. They like him more than Peter Sellers, but they also like a lot of things much more than Jerry Lewis. Things like baguettes and scarves and wine and so on.
Of course,
but they do like Jerry Lewis more than the German and the Russian army. Also, but the reason that Jerry Lewis I think is enjoyed by the French is that it's connected to a particular form of comedy that arose in France where people actually behaved as if they were crazy, like as if they engage in really foolish behaviors with these fits and tics and so on. And that's the style of comedy that Jerry Lewis really fostered in movies like The Bellboy and so on. And so in some ways, his form of physical comedy is much more French than it is American.
Ah.
With regard to Gilbert Gottfried, I have heard about this. I don't know the text of his joke, but Gilbert has a long history of doing this. So he made some jokes right at the heels of the 9/11 attacks. He made a joke after the tsunami that hit Japan. That actually he lost his job as the Affleck Duck.
Oh.
As a result of and actually Gilbert's behavior has really spawned some work in the Humor Research Lab that asks this question of when is a joke too soon.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we find is that the passage of time helps transform the things that are wrong in the world into things that are less wrong, and so waiting some amount of time is good for in terms of making a joke. But then also, my friend Alonzo Bowden, a very funny comedian, likes to say, it's not too soon if it's funny.
Mm.
And we found this to be the case when we were in New York and we met with one of the head writers of The Onion. And The Onion actually published one of its most famous articles about 2 weeks after the 9/11 attacks. Mm. And what The Onion did, which Gilbert doesn't tend to do, is that The Onion took aim not at the victims, but at the terrorists, and did it in a really, really funny way. And I think in some ways demonstrated some of the best ways that the humor can help us cope, because in addition to making us laugh, it also made these terrorists seem a lot less scary. Mm,
that seems really too soon to me, though, for a major event like that. It almost seems, without having seen it, irreverent.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, their job, as they see it, is satire, right? And it's to speak truth to power, and it's to point out the things that are absurd in the world, and I guess it depends a little bit on what your definition of funny is. If it's that you're getting a laugh and making people think, as long as you're getting a laugh and making people think, then you can be successful.
Yeah, well, thanks, Steve, so much for the call. Ben in Milwaukee, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Ben.
Am I on?
Yes, you are, Ben.
Yeah, my phone's dying. So really quickly, on the flip side of jokes being too soon, I wanted to ask about ancient plays like Lysistrata that are still being performed and are funny 3,000 years later.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a very nice question and a really interesting insight. Like, so what are the things that are universal, right? So what are the things that are funny, you know, funny long ago that can still be funny today? It seems to be the case that one of the first jokes ever written was about flatulence, and so very clearly that bodily function seems to be still a good topic of comedy. And you could think about physical forms of comedy, right? So Charlie Chaplin, you know, silent film,
I still do. Mm-hmm.
is still really quite amusing, in part because you don't need language. Right. So mm-hmm. you don't need, and he plays on sort of these universal themes, right? The bully, the guy wanting to get the girl. And as we traveled around the world, that was one of the things that Joel and I kept an eye out for. What are the universal things? And so the physical stuff was definitely the case. And then it was anything that you could find about a society that was consistent. So for instance, in Japan, we traded jokes with these comedians about our concerns over our lack of manhood. You know, the mother-in-law joke seems to be a fairly universal kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Things like making fun of the police, because the police have a similar role across countries. And so wherever you can find commonalities in the way people see the world. So in this case, you know, the idea of the battle of the sexes that occurs in Lysistrata. That's alive and well today.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben, so much for the call. Let's go next to Sean in Madison. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for the call. Growing up, Saturday Night Live was one of the best things to watch on Saturday night and then talk about in school on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Watching it throughout the years, it seems to have been on a extremely downward trend on what their humor is and what we want to laugh at. And I don't think Saturday Night Live is funny anymore. Did you study that at all?
I haven't, no. And, you know, here's the real difficulty with the puzzle you present is that what we call in Hurl, there's a confound. And that is that Saturday Night Live has changed, but so have you. And so the question becomes, is Saturday Night Live less funny, or is it you've matured in some way that you find other things enjoyable, or potentially both? Certainly, I think it seems to be the case that that if you look at it from a straight talent standpoint, Saturday Night Live has a lot more competition these days. And so there's just so many more outlets for funny people, whether it be you know, on their own show, like creating a 30 Rock like Tina Fey has done, you know, the many other comedy shows that exist out there. It could just be a little bit of comedy drain, you know, to be the case. And then some of it is, it's just when it comes to comedy, it's there's this premium placed on freshness, on novelty, and to the degree that a show like Saturday Night Live feels the same, It just gets tired as a result of it all.
Well, Peter, this has been just great fun. Thank you so much for being with us. Are you wearing your sweater vest today?
Of course.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Oh, nice. and you have a good name for a comedian, too. Peter McGraw, don't you think? Got a nice, nice ring.
Well, I don't know if I'm ever doing it again, but if I do, I'll...
You need to. Yeah, actually, okay. I should try that sometime before I die. That'd be fun. Thank you for being with us. It was great fun.
Thank you.
Peter McGraw, he directs the Humor Research Lab at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And he's also the co-author of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. I believe the article from the New York Times is on our Facebook page. I'm not sure, but if it isn't there, it will be there at some point. So you can look at the funniest cities in America. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks, everybody, for your calls. Susan Page from USA Today is our All Things Political guest on Monday at 1 o'clock. So join us for that. And thanks for listening today.